your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The True Crime Society podcast contains adult themes and violence and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
If you'd like to skip the intro, please refer to the timestamp listed in the episode description. Thank you.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the True Crime Society podcast. It's Stephanie and Olivia. It is July 18th right now. It
2024.
It is 7:30 p.m. And this has been like the craziest week. There's been so many celebrity deaths. There was an assassination attempt on Donald Trump. And it's just been like a real whirlwind here. I don't even know where to start because we're not going to get into like politics or anything like that, but thought it was worth acknowledging that that happened. And that is crazy and not something you expect to happen in your lifetime, an attempted assassination on live TV. Very scary.
We're still 2 whole days away from a full moon. So who knows what's going to happen this weekend? But it's been crazy. It was just nonstop this past week in terms, and not even so much just crime news, but in terms of things that are happening to public figures and just everything going on. It was just a wild, crazy week.
I really did Google a few days ago too when the full moon is, because I was like, what is going on?
I just looked it up because I feel like things have been wild earlier this month. Maybe I don't know what else is going on, but yeah, it's not even a full moon yet, so buckle up, guys.
It's in like 2 days, I think.
Yeah.
Three days.
I just looked it up on my app. 2 days.
But we also had the deaths of Shannon Doherty. I used to be a big Charmed fan, so that one was sad.
I was a big 90210 fan. Yeah.
Yeah. Richard Simmons, who he has like a crazy story that I have to read more about, but you know, he was a workout guy. Everyone, I feel like, knew who he was back in the day. He kind of turned into like a recluse and never left his house and disappeared from society for a long time.
And his death is interesting too. Like, apparently he fell in the bathroom and his housekeeper or someone who worked for him said he should go to the hospital, and he said no. And then the next day he was dead. So
yeah, I think he was just over it. I think he's also one of those people where his death had been faked a few times.
Yeah, like everyone was saying
on the social media
that maybe there was a cover up, and kind of because he wasn't seen for so long that maybe his team were covering things up. So yeah, an interesting death. And even Shannon Doherty, I know that she was very unwell and she had terminal cancer, but like her last Instagram post I was looking the other day was from end of June, and she spoke about doing a new type of chemo, and she said she didn't know if it would be 3 months or 6 months. So I feel like she must have declined very rapidly at the end. And even I saw some quotes from her doctor basically saying things like it changed very quickly and she just, you know, they had to make her comfortable. It just wasn't even an option anymore. So
with Richard Simmons, his was literally like a couple hours before the assassination attempt. I was like, damn, like everyone already forgot about it because there's so much going on. And then there was also the other one was Dr. Ruth. She was a sex therapist talk show like that everyone knew of, because she was kind of like a grandma talking about sex and giving advice on that. And whenever I was like, oh, Dr. Ruth died, people were like, she's not already dead?
No. There was also, because I know they always say these things come in threes, but then there was also Shelley Duvall, who died. She was the first of the four to die, I think, from diabetes complications. So yeah,
a couple hours ago, Bob Newhart died, who was a legendary comedian. He was an elf.
A lot going on.
Yeah, crazy times. Crazy times for sure. in my life, things feel crazy just with like work, living, surviving, but definitely not on that scale of crazy. Don't really have anything overly interesting going on. I was saying on Patreon, I got poison ivy. It's really like the biggest thing that's happened to me. But I was supposed to be going on vacation soon, and I'm so ready to go because I just need a break from my job and working and life. And I want to go to the beach, and I want to go to the pool, and I want to have a little swim and get a tan.
That'll be nice.
Yeah, what's going on with you?
Nothing, pretty quiet. We're still on winter break here. The kids go back to school next week. We just had a few days away down on the New South Wales South Coast, which was lovely. Like, it's so pretty down there. We saw, and always in summer when we go, it's always so busy. It's like ridiculous. Whereas I like going in winter, even though it's freezing cold, but it's so quiet. Like, it was beautiful. One day we went to the pub and there was all these dolphins playing in the water out the front. It was amazing. It was really, really nice. But yeah, good to be home. I'm looking forward to the kids going back to school next week. And then hopefully, like, we're now halfway, basically exactly through winter. So that's good. We're getting there slowly.
Woohoo. Peep just arrived. She's crawling into my lap.
Peep. Right on schedule.
She's meowing under the table. I don't know if the microphone will get it. Peep. There you go. The people never hear from you anymore. They're upset. Are you sorry? All right, she's going back under the table.
Had enough.
Yeah, she's just really busy. She has a lot of projects going on.
So our last episode was about Wade Wilson. There's been a kind of a little bit more activity in the past week from his supporters, I guess, because they had a deadline to
his supporters.
They had a deadline of when they could request that he doesn't get the death penalty, because that is going to happen next week, I believe. He's confirmed sentencing will happen next week. So there's been a lot of kind of activity online from people. Like, there's one account which I'm not going to even name because we don't encourage bullying.
No, don't give them attention.
Yeah, and I don't want them to get attention. But like, there's one where they'll post things like a video of him in the courtroom where he's mouthing "help me" and they'll do like a broken heart. Another one where he's flipping through court documents and I'm ad-libbing here, but it's basically along the lines of, "This is Wade reading all the signatures on the petition for him not to get the death penalty." And I'm like, this is kind of ridiculous.
It's so weird. It's like they write their own like fan fiction almost. Yeah. So gross.
And like, you know, a lot of the comments we've had, he is a good looking guy, and he was at one point, you know, relatively good looking. But I just feel like what he did is so horrific. I just can't even believe that women are on this bandwagon. But
that good looking.
No.
Like, he's not good looking enough that it should make you forget about the crazy, horrible things that he's done.
So we asked on our Instagram if people thought he should get the death penalty, and 96% of people said yes, 4% said no. We did have a few messages from people saying basically they're just against the death penalty all up, so that's why they voted no, not so much that he specifically doesn't deserve the death penalty, but it was an overwhelming yes, which I'm not surprised.
I did see two people were also like, I hit no by accident.
So that'll be happening probably by the time this episode comes out. So we would have maybe or be around the same time that he gets his sentence. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I suspect he'll probably get the death penalty. I don't know. I don't feel like these two, like, there was an article where it named there was three women, one in California, and they were the ones kind of spearheading this petition for him not to get the death penalty.
And someone reshared like our post about it, basically being like, wow, he is like kind of hot, like he can choke me. I was like, bitch, get out of here.
So they had a goal of 5,000, I'm just looking at this account now, 5,000 signatures to save Wade Wilson from the death penalty. And just today they had 1,138.
That's still way more than they should get.
Yeah, I agree. So this person is just still sharing. Anyway,
I guess, like, unless urgent. It's people who just don't believe in the death penalty is one thing, but not people who are just like have a crush on him.
It says they wanted to get 100,000 signatures, so they kind of fell short of that. But I do find it interesting that on this account, they aren't following anyone. Like, I feel like, so that kind of indicates that they don't want anyone to know who they are, which I also would not if I was acting out in this crazy way. But yeah, they fell very short of their 100,000 goal. And you know what? If Wade did some kind of petty, stupid crime and he was good looking, you know, and obviously he wouldn't be getting the death penalty then, but just the heinousness of his crimes where he ran over a woman until he said she looked like spaghetti. That was his quote.
And no remorse.
No remorse. Doesn't give a shit. Had the opportunity to cover up his repulsive offensive tattoos and didn't. Like, he's just a jerk and a loser, and he deserves whatever punishment the court sees fit. So anyway, it's just wild that some people are into that.
Yeah, concerning for sure.
Yeah.
It's Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances and save an additional $1,000 when you buy four select LG major appliances. Plus, get a free DeWalt 20-volt max 5-amp-hour battery when you buy a select DeWalt 20-volt max tool. Get the job done for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/26. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for more details and qualifying items.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Okay, so we'll get into today's subject. We're going to be talking about a case that is from Australia. So Olivia will have to be the star in this one, because the more I was reading about it, I was like, wow, this one runs like super deep.
Yeah.
You'll know more about it than me. I don't know the lore of the story. It's the case of Peter Falconio, who is a British man, and he disappeared in the outback of Australia in July 2001. And his remains have never been found. And it's just like a really scary, terrifying story that even like horror movies have been based off of. Like one, if you ever watched the movie Wolf Creek, it's kind of loosely based on this case.
So yeah, we've had this one suggested to us to cover a few times. Maisie M was the most recent person who suggested it. I'm very familiar with this case. This is probably right around the time that it happened that I first started getting really interested in true crime. And I remember the whole country was swept up in it because it was so unbelievable and terrifying. And I've seen Wolf Creek. It is absolutely terrifying. It's obviously, like, when we say loosely based, very loosely based, because what happens in Wolf Creek is not the same, but the same kind of premise of being abducted by a stranger in the desert. It's crazy.
Yeah. It kind of just seems like a stranger murder, which, as far as we know anyways, but those are always very scary. And just reading about kind of like all the controversy and all the opinions about it almost reminded me of how like the Scott Peterson case is here, even though it's like totally different story, but just the public having very passionate different opinions on it. Basically, a quick summary before we get into it. Him and his girlfriend were driving. Someone was driving near them, kind of like flagged them down to fake like, oh, there's something like wrong with your car, pull over. They pulled over. Peter ends up getting out of the car to talk to the guy. The guy shoots him, kills him apparently, and then tries to like gets the girlfriend out of the car, like ties her up, tries to do whatever with her. She ends up escaping, and then it's kind of just like no one really knows what happened. His remains have never been found, like I said. So that is the brief summary. So for those who haven't heard of it.
There was this incredible story hijacked in the middle of Australia, and her boyfriend was missing.
It's hard to imagine anywhere that's more isolated than the outback.
The person involved in this incident is armed and dangerous.
I couldn't imagine a more frightening and intimidating experience.
That magic combination of the British tourist, the human interest, the murder, the mystery.
There was evidence that was a lot of blood there.
If I could say one thing to this man, I would ask him to let the police know where Pete is.
She's the only one that can actually tell anyone exactly what happened that night.
You can't make up DNA profiles. It's either there or it's not there.
This is the first time I've been exposed to that type of voracious, shark-feeding frenzy of the media.
Everyone had a theory.
The question I have is, where is Peter Falconio?
We really still don't know what happened. We really still don't know.
So we'll start off with a little bit of background on the people involved. Peter was born Peter Marco Falconio on September 20th, 1972. He has three brothers, and he lived with his family in Hepworth, England. His parents are Joan and Luciano Falconio. So the other person involved in this story is his girlfriend, Joanne Lees. Joanne was born on September 25th, 1973. Her mother was Jenny, and she was raised by her stepfather, Vincent. Joanne worked as a bartender and a bacon packer before getting a job as a travel agent. Peter and Joanne met in 1996 in a nightclub in England. In 1997, they moved in together in Brighton, as that's where Peter was studying in college at university. And on November 15th, 2000, Joanne and Peter left for a big trip around the world. Their itinerary included Nepal, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Cambodia, and Australia. So a big trip. Then on January 16th, 2001, they arrived in Sydney. They both had working holiday visas, and it sounds like they worked to earn some more money before departing on an Australian road trip on June 25th, 2001. They planned to go to Sydney, Canberra, Melbourne, Adelaide, Darwin, and Brisbane. They'd purchased an orange Volkswagen Combi camper van to use for their trip. It's a Combi.
We say Combi. I don't know if it's like different there. Oh, so it's underneath. Combi? There's the photo of it. It's kind of like, yeah. Like a really
it's
iconic
like a,
old.
It's the Volkswagen van.
Yeah.
They just brought it back recently too, I think. And they did like an electric version, I think. So the trip went well until the evening of Saturday, July 14th, 2001. At 7:30 p.m. that night, they were traveling on the Stuart Highway bound for the Devil's Marbles. They were around 310 kilometers or 200 miles north of Alice Springs, which is super remote.
Like if you were looking at a map of Australia, we've got a blog on this, so check it out if you want to see the exact location. But basically, it's smack bang in the middle of Australia. This is, you couldn't get much more remote than this. Sometimes you'll drive for hours and hours and not see another vehicle. A lot of the highway there is kind of only two lanes, one lane each way, just because it's so flat and so straight. It's easy to pass if there is someone that you really need to pass. But this is the absolute middle of the outback. If you're wondering what the Devil's Marbles are, basically they're kind of a natural formation of rocks. It says, travelers on the Stuart Highway can experience a range of the territories, which is Northern Territories, amazing natural landscapes, especially the impressive site of Devil's Marbles or Kalu Kalu. These gigantic boulders have become an internationally recognized symbol of the Australian outback and are spectacular when the light in the morning and evening sun highlights their deep red color. Kalu Kalu translates to round boulders. So basically, just to give you an idea of where this happened, literally nothing around. You would have to drive sometimes for hours and hours to reach like a roadhouse or a petrol station. Literally no one around, especially if you needed help, like a situation like this.
So Peter was driving at the time and Joanne was in the front passenger seat. And the two noticed that a car had been following behind them since they stopped at a roadhouse in Barrow Creek. They kept waiting for the car to like pass them, but that didn't happen. It's a flat two-lane road, so if he wanted to pass them, it would have been easy to do. So kind of strange that he wasn't. The other car that was following them was a green Toyota four-wheel drive Land Cruiser, and it eventually ended up kind of like pulling up next to them, and the driver gestured, quote, excitedly at them to pull over, like trying to flag them down. So Peter did pull the car over and he got out of the car and went to speak with the man. Joanne, talking about the incident, she said, Pete was going to stop and I asked him not to, which I would also be like, don't fucking pull over.
Yeah. And like in the night, it was like evening in winter, it would be dark, it would be cold. No, I would also probably not be stopping.
In the middle of nowhere. But it's also like scary because it's like, what does this guy want? Like, is he just going to follow us forever? Not a situation I'd want to find myself in. So the man told Peter that he saw sparks shooting out of the exhaust of their car. Joanne would later talk about what happened. She said, Pete said, cheers, mate. Thanks for stopping. He asked him if he'd noticed the sparks coming out of the exhaust all the time. He'd been following us.
So just that I've read when I was doing the research for this, there's kind of two versions of this story that Joanne and Peter had noticed that this guy had been following them for a little while. And they were like, why isn't he overtaking us if that's what he wants? And the other one is that they kind of didn't realize that. And all of a sudden he started driving next to them and like gesturing for them to stop. So I'm not sure which is exactly true. It does, when she said like when he was following us, it kind of seems like that. But there's two versions of the story, which we'll get into more discussion about that later too. But there's, yeah, some different versions of what happened.
So Peter then returned to the front of the car and got his cigarettes and asked Joanne to rev the engine so that he could check to see if there were sparks. She said, I didn't really know what I was supposed to be doing as I was revving the engine. I kept revving the engine and stopping, and then I heard a bang. At first, it just sounded like a car backfiring.
I'm not sure exactly of the time, but it was pitch black. There was headlights behind us. Pete slowed down. He said to me, I wish this car would just overtake us. After a few minutes, the car drove alongside us. Both looked into the vehicle and we could see a man and his dog. The man was pointing at the back of our vehicle and motioning us to stop.
What did he look like?
He looked age 40 plus. He looked like a local man, I would say. It was a four-wheel drive utility truck.
When you pulled up, did the individual get out and come to your vehicle?
Pete met him halfway. The vehicle parked behind our vehicle. Pete went to the back of our vehicle and the mum was there waiting for Pete.
Why didn't you get out?
Pete told me to wait there. It was cold. I was just in shorts and a t-shirt. Pete took his cigarettes, went, had a chat with the man. He came back, he asked me to rev the engine. I sat in the driver's seat, moved across from the passenger seat. He said he reassured me that everything was okay. The door was open ajar. I heard him talking to the man. All seemed amicable, joking. I could hear Pete saying, cheers, mate, thanks for stopping. Just seemed all friendly.
And while you were sitting in the front and Peter was at the back, were you looking in the rearview mirror to see if you could catch another glimpse of the man?
Yeah, I saw him again. Very clearly, we made eye contact. He looked at me. I can't explain it. It just made me feel a little uncomfortable.
Joanne started to rev the engine. It was the last time she would ever see Peter.
I heard a bang. I automatically thought, oh, it's the exhaust. Stopped revving the engine. Turned to look around. The man was stood outside the driver's door. I saw the gun in his hand, pointing it at me. He started to open the door. He asked me to switch the engine off and to move over across to the passenger side. He said, put your head down and your hands behind your back.
Joanne said that the car, which was 30 years old, had backfired a lot during their trip, so wouldn't be weird if that was what happened. But seconds after the bang, the man appeared at her window with a gun. Joanne said that she fought with the man and tried to kick him in the groin. The man managed to secure her hands behind her back with cable ties. She said, I just kept thinking this was not happening to me. I couldn't believe this was happening. I felt alone. I kept shouting for Pete and thought I was going to die. I was more scared of being raped than of being shot by the man.
He said again, put your head down and your hands behind your back. And then he put a gun to my head. And that's when I thought, I'm going to have to do as he tells me. He tied my hands together. He tied them behind my back using four cable ties. So there was one around each wrist and then two in the middle joining them.
So although they were tied together, yeah, there was a bit of space.
Space, yeah. I was just screaming for Pete. I thought at any moment Pete was just going to come and save me.
So you're shrieking?
Yeah.
And what is he saying in answer to that?
He just pushes me out of the car then, onto the ground. At that point, I'm just so angry. He's trying to tie my legs together. And I just won't let him. I just kick and kick and kick, and he can't do that. I think because of that, he just got really mad and he hit me.
Where did he hit you?
Side of my face.
What was your reaction to that?
I was stunned and I just kept thinking, oh my god, I'm gonna die. Where is Pete? I just kept thinking, okay, this is over. It's the end of my life. He drags me or lifts me up and he tries to put tape across my mouth. Swing my head around, move it around, and it just goes around my neck and in my hair. He walked me towards his vehicle and he just pulled me and grabbed me and pushed me into the back of his vehicle, which had some kind of bed in there.
She also said, the realization hit me that he might have killed Pete. I just got some energy from somewhere, some inner strength. My focus was just escaping, and that is what I concentrated on, just getting out of there. So the man managed to drag her to his Toyota truck. She said, he hit me, punched me in the head. It stunned me. Joanne said the man pulled a sack over her head, which she managed to shake off, tried unsuccessfully to tape her mouth, and forced her into the front of his truck, where there was apparently a dog, a broad, chunky dog is the quote. She said the man somehow pushed me into the rear of his vehicle. Joanne said while lying in the rear of the truck, she asked the man why he was doing this. Did he want money? Did he want to rape me? He came back and told me to shut up or he'd shoot me. She said, he went away and did something. I just kept thinking about Pete. Had he shot Pete? And just kept asking the man if he'd killed Pete and what he'd done. Joanne said that after hearing a noise like gravel scraping on the ground as if he was moving something, she managed to slide out of the vehicle and drop to the ground. Joanne ran into the brush nearby and hid from the man. She said, I just thought I'm definitely going to die.
I just thought, this is it. This is my chance. I'm going. And I just slid down the truck, down the base of the truck, jumped out, and just ran into the bush.
Could you see anything?
Couldn't see anything. I tripped up a few times. I just crawled into a bush and hid. I heard his footsteps crunching the branches, and I saw the torch.
You saw the torch?
Yeah.
How close?
Very close. It came past me three or four times. Shone the torch above me in the trees.
Joanne eventually heard her attacker drive away in the camper van.
Thought he's leaving. He's going. But then I heard him come back.
In the same vehicle?
On foot.
What are your feelings at that point?
I was just thinking, is this ever going to end? That's what I thought. Thought that he's going to be so mad when he finds me. And he's really determined to find me.
So like we said, the landscape's very remote. A lot of like brush, kind of deserty.
Yeah,
dry, flat.
I've been through the outback a while ago now, but I've been through the outback, so I know exactly the type of area where they're picturing. There are like a few trees here and there, but mainly it's kind of scrub, thickish brush. So in terms of hiding, like it's not like you'd be quite limited on places that you could run and hide. You'd have to find something big enough to cover you, which there wouldn't be much. Like I've seen a few reenactments of this, of when Joanne kind of left and ran away. And I feel like this is the most terrifying part, because he came so close to her so many times and she actually had nowhere to hide. Like, you know, imagine just trying to crouch down behind a scrubby bush thing. It's wild that she managed to hide from this guy.
Yeah. And it's also like, how did he not find her in a way?
But I guess just being dark and there being absolute no light. Like, I don't know if he had a torch or what.
Yeah.
But like there was nothing around, no lights. I'm assuming at that point he probably didn't have like a cell phone torch or anything. She just got very lucky.
I'm sure after shooting a guy, he was like, all right, I need to get out of here.
Yeah, I can't be hanging around with this dead body in my car. So when I say she was lucky, obviously she wasn't lucky to be involved in this whole situation, but this small amount of luck that she had in managing to evade this guy despite the landscape that didn't help her is one positive in this case.
Yeah. The man searched for her. She said that he passed her three times, and she said that he got as close as 18 inches or 45 centimeters for about 10 to 15 seconds. She said, I was looking at him and he was looking at me. She hid under a bush for a very long time, trying not to breathe. She said she heard the man searching for her before she heard more dragging noises, doors opening and closing, and then the vehicles being driven away.
I read it when they say vehicles that he took their combi and then he dumped it and then he came back and got the other one. But yeah, I know there's a lot of speculation.
So she said, I thought he's come back to look for me. So maybe that's when she heard it come back. She said, I just had no energy to get out of the situation. I felt exhausted. So she managed to flag down a truck driver at 12:35 a.m., which was 5 hours after this all started, and that man took her back to Barrow Creek.
So Joanne was kind of rescued by the truck driver at 12:30. The police in Alice Springs were called at 1:30 a.m. And just to give you an idea of how remote the area is, Barrow Creek, where she was taken back to, is around a three-hour drive from Alice Springs. So the closest police were a three-hour drive away. Police arrived to start investigating at around 4:20 a.m. The truck driver who helped Joanne took them back to the area where he found her, and they started searching for Peter at around 7 a.m.
A huge manhunt is underway in the Northern Territory, where a gunman is believed to have kidnapped a British tourist and terrorised his girlfriend.
We consider the person involved in this incident is armed and dangerous.
Within 24 hours, over 100 police, volunteers and aircraft had been deployed in the search for the gunman.
Police set up some roadblocks and there was a huge manhunt going on, and amazing detours around the area were being put in place.
The roadblocks really didn't get enacted until the Sunday morning. So you're talking 12, 16 hours from when it actually happened.
Investigators said that they found a dirt-covered pool of blood, and the combi had been hidden around 80 metres or around 250 feet off the road in scrub. So he'd kind of driven it so it didn't draw any attention to it, or it kind of delayed any attention being drawn to it if it was on the side of the road, because I guess, you know, someone might have stopped to say, do you need help, is there anyone around? So he kind of moved it to stop it being noticed so quickly. There was a delay in putting roadblocks on the highway in place, and this would have meant, if they had have done this, it would have meant that vehicles in the area were stopped and searched. But this did not happen until 8 hours after Joanne was rescued. So in that time, 8 hours in the desert, you could basically get anywhere. Aboriginal trackers were also called in to help search for Peter. This happened within days of the incident, but none of them found any evidence relating to Peter or the gunman. If you're not familiar with what an Aboriginal tracker does, this is some information about the use of trackers by police. It says, since early times, government agencies, explorers, surveyors, and members of the general public called upon the tracking abilities of Aboriginal men and women. The skills of trackers were drawn from the bush and hunting knowledge held by Aboriginal groups. A good tracker could pick up the smallest change in the landscape and quickly work out in which direction a person or animal was moving. So in a lot of cases in the outback, in the desert, in cases of missing people, they will often bring trackers in because they can kind of figure out changes to the landscape, different things that are out of place. So that's what they did in this case too, but they weren't able to find anything. The lack of evidence that was found, as we mentioned, they only found the small pool of blood and not much else, as well as the kind of sensational, unbelievable nature of this story, led many to start suspecting Joanne and maybe that she had some involvement in Peter's death. And I remember at the time, absolutely, this is what happened in the media. She was very dramatic. She would often be seen sobbing, and like people, I believe, you know, said that she had crocodile tears and that type of thing, that she just seemed maybe a little bit unbelievable.
I saw a lot of people saying how in her, like her first appearance, she was wearing a tight t-shirt that said Cheeky Monkey or something.
Yeah. Like cut, but then do you know what? Also, she was traveling. She probably didn't have. Anyway, we can speak about it more. But like, absolutely, this is what happened at the time.
Yeah.
So Joanne would later admit that her story had been altered from what she originally told police to what she ended up telling police. She would tell a court that she started to doubt herself after police told her there were no four-wheel drive trucks that allowed access from the front cabin to the tray at the back. She first told police at the time that Peter went missing that her attacker had forced her into the back of the vehicle through a space between the front seats. And Joanne said, that's what I believed at the time, but it was after that interview with police that I started to doubt myself. She would also later change her story to say that she couldn't remember how she got from the front of the vehicle into the rear before managing to escape. Joanne was also asked very early on to help police produce an image of her attacker, and this was around 48 hours after Peter, the whole incident happened. She said she couldn't say whether her attacker wore a hat. She said, I can't see at that point because black against the black of night just sort of blends in. I just saw his face and the gun. But she had originally told police that the attacker had worn a cap. And she said, I said that, but it doesn't mean he didn't have a hat on. It means that I just didn't register it, or he may have had the hat on, but I was just looking at his face, into his eyes and at the gun. So this is the kind of things that were being said by Joanne, which led to a lot of scrutiny and speculation about her and her role in the incident in the media. It was kind of back and forth. People were questioning why her story was changing.
And I get both sides because, like, obviously you're just like, what do you mean? Like, you don't know. But also if you're like in survival mode, just something very traumatic, like your brain probably isn't really focused on that. And you can dissociate, like you don't remember everything when you're exposed to like such a traumatic situation. Yeah. So yeah, I get both sides.
So police did look into CCTV from around the area, and they found some that had been taken at a Shell truck stop in Alice Springs, which was a few hours after the alleged murder. And this showed a vehicle that was similar to the one that Joanne had described. And I remember when they released this and everyone was kind of on edge. It was quite a distinctive looking vehicle. Like there's not a ton of them around at that time. So even I remember I saw one at a petrol station where I was once, and I was like, oh my gosh. It was clearly not him, but I was thinking at the time it might have been.
Yeah.
So when they released the footage, police hoped that it would mean that the person in the CCTV wasn't really involved and would come forward and they'd be able to eliminate that person from the case, but this didn't happen. So investigators began to focus more and more on the vehicle involved. They investigated all registered owners of 1991 to 1999 Toyota Land Cruisers, and they also started looking into tips. They had received the names of 36 men from people who called in tips, and those people had said that they knew someone who resembled the man in the footage. One of the men that police tracked down through this information was Bradley John Murdoch. He was first interviewed by police in Broome in Western Australia on the 1st of November 2001. Some info into Bradley's background. He was born on the 19th of February 1958 and he was born in Geraldton in Western Australia. He was an unexpected baby and he had two older brothers who were 11 and 14 by the time he was born. His parents were Colin Murdoch, who was a mechanic, and Nancy, who was a hairdresser. So the family moved to Perth when Bradley was 12. It was said that he had problems adjusting to life in the city and he soon became involved with a gang. Bradley dropped out of high school at the age of 15 and he moved back to Geraldton, and that's when he became involved in the kind of gang-related criminal activities. He started his own trucking business at one point, but he declared bankruptcy in 1983. In 1980, Bradley met a woman named Diane, and they would get married in 1984 and they had a son together, but by 1986, they were separated due to domestic violence issues. By that point, Bradley was working as a truck driver, but which was basically a cover for being a drug smuggler. It has been said that he had white supremacist tendencies and he also had racist tattoos. In terms of his criminal history, in 1980, when he was 21, Bradley received a suspended sentence after being convicted of causing the death by dangerous driving after he hit and killed a motorcyclist in South Australia. In November 1995, he was in prison for 21 months because he was drunk and started shooting at people who were celebrating at an Indigenous Australian Rules football grand final match in the Kimberley region of Western Australia, and he was released after 15 months. Just to jump slightly ahead chronologically, in 2003, so after Peter Falconio was murdered, he was charged with two counts of rape of a 12-year-old girl at Swan Reach in South Australia, but he was later acquitted of those charges. So even though he was acquitted, he was not a nice guy. He had a lot going on, just a general dirtbag. So Joanne stayed in Australia for a few months after Peter went missing. They searched for him. Nothing was found. By the end of that year, she went home to England. After police first interviewed Bradley in relation to the Falconio case in 2001, they didn't collect DNA at the time because there was nothing that really immediately connected him to the case. He denied being in the area, like he had the same car, but essentially I guess you can't just demand DNA if you have nothing really tying him to the case at the time.
Yeah.
The next year, May 2002, investigators caught a drug smuggling accomplice named James Heppy. That person knew Bradley, and James began to tell police of Bradley's connection to the Falconio case. DNA was taken from Bradley's brother, and this tied Bradley to the Falconio scene. So in 2003, Bradley was arrested and charged with the murder of Peter Falconio. He was extradited from South Australia to the Northern Territory, and at that point the police did take DNA, and that sample matched DNA that had been found on Joanne's t-shirt. So Bradley's trial started in October 2005 and it concluded in December 2005. 81 witnesses were called and the jury consisted of 6 men, 6 women and 3 reserves. So this trial was so big. I remember it happening in Australia. They had to renovate the court building due to the size.
That's crazy.
Because I guess nothing of this magnitude really ever happens there, or anything with this amount of media interest anyway. So yeah, they had to renovate the court building to a cost of almost $1 million, and this was to be able to ensure that the demands of the trial and also the huge media contingent would be able to be housed within the courtroom. So I guess that kind of delayed proceedings a little bit, but it finally kicked off in 2005. Bradley denied all involvement in the attack. He denied being in the area at the time. Joanne came back to Australia to testify during the trial. She said that she identified Bradley as her attacker from photographs that had been shown to her, and she confirmed that when she saw him face to face that he was definitely her attacker. During the trial, it was found that Bradley left Alice Springs at a time and travelled in the direction of Barrow Creek, which indicated that he was likely in the area at the time of the murder. Expert testimony indicated that he was the man who was seen on CCTV at the Shell station, and both Bradley's father and James Heppy, who was his business associate, also corroborated this version of events at the trial. Bradley's DNA was found on a pair of homemade handcuffs that had been used in the attack, and as we mentioned earlier, his DNA was also found on Joanne's T-shirt. It was said that the T-shirt DNA was found to be 150 quadrillion times more likely to belong to Bradley than to anyone else. His DNA was also found on the gear stick of the Combi. Bradley's defense team tried to argue that the DNA could have been there due to an accidental blood transfer at a Red Rooster restaurant in Alice Springs prior to Peter being attacked. Bradley has said that he stopped there to buy chicken for himself and his dog, and Joanne said that at one point she and Peter also stopped there, so they ran with that.
Seems like a stretch.
Yeah, maybe there was some type of crossover because they were both at a fast food restaurant at the same time. His defense team also tried to argue that it could have been planted. So like during the trial, there was a lot about Joanne's character brought up, about the stories that had changed, that they kind of tried to bring her story into disrepute and, you know, argue that she was in on this and that everything had been planted and that basically Bradley wasn't involved and that he was being set up.
Mm-hmm.
Despite all of this kind of dragging Joanne through the mud, on 13th of December 2005, Bradley was found guilty by the jury in a unanimous verdict. He was sentenced to life imprisonment with a non-parole period of 28 years. He was also convicted on charges of assaulting Joanne. On the 12th of December 2006, Bradley first appealed his sentence in the Supreme Court. His team claimed that Joanne's evidence was tainted because she had seen a photo of him online before she was interviewed by police. So what I've read in terms of that is that I believe she was on holiday in Italy or something, and her friends sent her an article about the case, and in the photo they had maybe linked Bradley or said that he was under suspicion of the case and she had seen him before the police had questioned her about it. His appeal ended up being dismissed by the Northern Territory Court of Criminal Appeal in January 2007. He then applied for special leave to appeal to the High Court of Australia, and this was refused in June 2007. And it's believed now that basically all avenues of appeal have been exhausted. There definitely hasn't been much in the media about him in the last, decade. So it seems like he doesn't really have anywhere to go in terms of what he can do now unless some new evidence or something like that comes up.
Yeah.
There have been some later developments that are interesting and of note. So as we mentioned earlier, Bradley's defense team tried to say that his DNA was transferred at the Red Rooster restaurant because he got chicken for himself and his dog. In 2006, the Bulletin reported that Bradley had refused to eat chicken in prison and said that he was allergic to it. He said he had a prison dietitian assigned to create a special menu due to this allergy, and he requested that he never be served chicken. So that's a pretty wild.
So, oops.
Yeah, oops, a bit of a conflicting story there.
Chicken allergy is crazy, I feel like.
I wonder if that's true.
Or if he's just being like, yeah, dramatic.
So they did bring a nobody, no parole law into Australia, which I feel like we've spoken about in another episode.
Yeah, we've spoken about it in a few, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, with what's her name? The woman who went missing, they arrested the kid.
Samantha Murphy.
Yeah, yes, crazy story. Nothing with that. Recently.
Yeah. So a lot of states in Australia do have nobody, no parole law, which basically means if you are convicted of a murder or, you know, and you don't tell them where the body is, you'll never get out. You have no chance. So they brought this law into effect in the Northern Territory in an effort to get Bradley to reveal where he put Peter's body. In 2007, it was apparently speculated that Bradley might have been about to reveal where he put Peter because he didn't like the prison he was in and he would speak in exchange for a transfer. That never happened. In April 2017, the Northern Territory News received an anonymous letter claiming that Bradley had cut Peter's body up and placed it in two bags. The letter claimed that an associate was asked to dissolve the remains in acid and dispose of them in the Swan River in Perth, but the associate had instead gone past Geraldton and buried the bags unopened in remote Western Australia. The Northern Territory News forwarded the letter to the Northern Territory Police, who said they were reviewing the letter. So that was 2017. Nothing much seems to have come from it. Either they weren't able to corroborate the claims or it was found to be false, but it seems like kind of another false lead. Just in terms of where Bradley could have put Peter's body, I wouldn't even be surprised if he doesn't quite know or can't pinpoint it. I've never ever seen it said that he said it was in this general area even, but yeah. The desert and the outback is so remote. literally,
especially like all this time later now.
Yeah, and there would be scavengers, like animals scavenged. I suspect that they will likely never find any part of Peter.
Yeah.
His mother, Peter's mother, Joan, did say in 2022 that she appealed to anyone with a conscience to reveal where his remains are. That would have been his 50th birthday. And Joan said, "Our pain is always with us. His life stopped on a lonely road, shot dead by cowardly Murdoch, who will not reveal what he did with him. We want to bring Peter home where he belongs." So the investigation into Peter's case was said to be one of the most exhaustive police investigations ever seen in Australia. And it absolutely was. I would believe that. The media coverage was intense, but they still haven't been able to find his body. I don't think they will. It's such an interesting case to study in terms of how Joanne was treated. Interesting in terms of witness memory for her, you know, in terms of her different stories. There's a lot of facets of this case that are super interesting and are still being discussed and talked about to this day.
Yeah, I think it's really sad what happened to Joanne, because then I was just reading about it online, and even still to this day, like, a lot of people are very suspicious of her, which, I mean, I guess, like, she could have had some part in it. I feel like probably not, but it just goes to show that you can't always, like, base your thoughts and opinions off of how someone is reacting to something traumatic and that happened to them, or how they're handling grief, because not everyone reacts the same way.
I will say, at the time, I do remember her interviews and her articles, and I thought, there's something weird going on here. This is very, very strange. Like, the whole story didn't add up. And we now know that was probably just due to her being traumatized and unable to remember correctly, or unable to remember every single detail. But I do remember at the time, I also thought it was a strange way for someone to behave. But I guess it just shows that you can never know how you will react when faced with this incredible trauma, this horrific, terrifying situation.
But it's also like, yeah, the media, like, when they're, you have to blame them a lot, because the way that they're framing it to people is like the narrative that's being pushed. Like, they're the ones that are putting out the clips of her and maybe like putting out headlines that are suspicious of her and stuff, you know, like, they're framing it that way, and then more people start to believe that. But I have also seen people about how she didn't remember. I don't think it's crazy to not remember when you're literally like being attacked and afraid for your life and someone just got murdered in front of you, basically. But I have seen people also speculate about drugs and stuff like that, because I guess the killer was involved with like drug running and stuff. So I'm not sure if they could have been involved in that. That's what's frustrating about this as well, is like, there's really absolutely no motive that anyone knows of.
Yeah. And so part of the reason why people suspected Joanne was like, you know, obviously they're like, maybe they were traveling together and they couldn't handle it and she snapped and she got rid of the body and she's making up this story. So at the time she was, after obviously she was, and I believe this also happened before Bradley was arrested, she was eligible for compensation as she'd been victim of a crime. So I think she received around $25,000 for that. She also was paid £50,000 for an interview that she did with Martin Bashir. And basically she said later on, when she was criticised for taking money and profiting off this horrible thing that had happened to Peter, she said she did it to raise awareness of the case in Australia, as she felt the public profile of, you know, the case had been diminished and she still wanted people to look for Peter. She also wrote a book called No Turning Back. So these are the kind of things that raised eyebrows around Joanne at the time. Do you know what I mean? Like, why is she doing this? Why is she profiting? She was interviewed by Women's Day, and she was also, there's been like a 60 Minutes, there's probably been a few 60 Minutes. I've seen at least one story on her and her ordeal. So people are like, why is she doing this? Which is part of, she kind of, I'm going to say she didn't help herself, but that they were the kind of things that happened for people to question why she was doing things, why she was getting money. But you know what? She's been involved in this horrible situation. It would have cost her a ton of money to stay here, you know, and wait for the trial and to come back for the trial. So I understand that, you know, she probably needed some type of financial help in terms of, you know, trying to get justice in the case and finding out what happened to Peter.
Yeah. And even though this wasn't like that long ago, I do think times were very different then, with kind of, yeah, like mental health and being just like generally more understanding, and like the media in general just like shitting on women and making a spectacle of things. So I do think people are a lot more understanding nowadays, and there's more studies into how trauma and all of that affects people. Because even, like, it's good that she got money as a victim, and it's shitty that people, like, will side-eye that and try to make the victim feel guilty. Because I couldn't even imagine having, like, my boyfriend, partner murdered, me almost get murdered, have to fight for my life, and then hide in a bush for 5 hours.
Yeah.
And then
in
just
the freezing,
be like, all
right. Cold desert. Yeah.
Yeah. And then be in the middle of the outback nowhere where you have to, like, wait for someone might not even find you. Like, how fucking horrifying that all would be. And then just be like, all right, well, I got to go back to work. Got to get my life back on track. Like, because you obviously need money. So I do think it's a good thing in general for victims to be compensated in that sense, especially after going through something so horrible. Like, people can't just be expected to be like, okay, back to normal.
And even the amount of money that she seems to have received, like, it maybe she got, let's just say, even £100,000 or something. That's not going to change your life. Like, yeah, like, it might have made things easier for a little amount of time for her, but it's not a life-changing amount of money. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah. And I don't know if you said, I did see people online also talking about how, like, she's being side-eyed because she was maybe, like, having an affair, or she, like, met up with some other guy. So, I mean, I guess that would make you, like, more suspicious, but it's also, like, not saying this about her specifically, but someone could, like, be a shitty person and still be, like, a victim of a horrible crime and be a victim. Like, just because they're a shitty person or do shitty things doesn't mean they weren't just, like, 100% a victim of something terrible.
There's a lot of still current discussion on this, despite it happening so long, but there's quite a lot of discussion online. This is an interesting comment I just read about the whole thing. It says, Northern Territory has a very different approach to law enforcement than the rest of the country. One example would be that you can be locked up without paperwork. Nowhere else in the country would this fly, nowhere. But the Northern Territory is considered special, the closest so far as perception of being predominantly outback. They said Joanne didn't behave the way she was supposed to. She didn't like the police. She didn't like the media. So she had apparently cheated on Peter in the past, and, like, that was made public. It said, given that she had cheated on Peter and it could possibly have been a nothing event had it not been for the fact that her partner was murdered in a case that went international. The biometric, and it just goes on and on. It says, the location plays a part in perception in this case, but environmental and sociological factors are very much at place. It's a very beautiful and vast environment, but it has a dark side, and going north, as in Northern Territory, is very much on a criminal's agenda after a lot of serious crimes. So it was, I for it to happen where it did, for Joanne to be treated how she was, and then for her to also kind of act how she did, it just was a perfect storm of circumstances to lead to a lot of conspiracy theories and arguments about if Bradley Murdoch is, and still to this day people argue about it.
Yeah, like, I saw a lot of recent stuff still of people thinking he could be innocent. I think the DNA, though, on her shirt, and especially, like, in the car, that's pretty non-refutable in my mind.
There's one here too. This is an interesting comment. It basically, someone said, how did Joanne's hair tie end up in the back of the car if she was never in the car and all this stuff? Like, you know, in terms of the different stories and how she got from the front to the back or whatever. Someone said,
that's
this
what
seems
a lot
like
people are hung up on.
Yeah. This seems like a case of grief policing. Joanne is bitchy and wears the wrong kind of t-shirt. Bing bang. She's a cold-blooded killer who murdered her boyfriend to be with her other boyfriend. So
I saw that comment, yeah.
Yeah. It's, yeah, it would be very interesting to study this case from end to end, see how people reacted, how the media reacted, how Joanne reacted. It's
how women are treated.
Yeah, exactly. But then also, like, and I'm not going against Joanne here. Obviously, it seems like Bradley Murdoch was the murderer. She was treated horrifically. But then you get people like Carly Russell who try and, Sherry Papini.
Ruin it for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. So there is a reason why sometimes people are skeptical about women and their, or even men as well, but, you know, we're specifically
victims,
discussing a woman here and women, female cases. So there are reasons why people sometimes are a bit wary to believe these wild, outrageous stories, but this is a case where it was true. The unbelievable really did happen in this case.
And it's just, I think that just so hard for people to really come to terms with, because there really still is no motive. There's really no answers. Like, why did he attack them? Why? We don't know.
Yeah.
So people try, like, people need the why. So that's why they, like, come up with all this stuff about Joanne and things that seem maybe most likely to them, because not having a why is, like, really scary to people.
I wonder if he did see them at the Red Rooster or he did see them at some point along the road and he maybe wanted to rape Joanne or sexually abuse her and then murder her, and that's why he – like, I feel like this was absolutely just a crime of opportunity. It just depends on when he came across them and what he wanted the outcome to be. He clearly didn't want Peter to hang around because he shot him straight away. But, yeah, I would love to know more about his motive, and it's never, ever really been revealed. I just suspect it was probably sexual abuse and being a general creep.
Yeah, I saw a comment that it's pretty long, so I won't read it, but it was along those same lines of, like, they had crossed paths at the Red Rooster. He wanted to assault her, followed them, and got rid of Peter. Also, he was, like, already a criminal, so it's not like he was, like, this great outstanding guy to begin with. And just kind of, like, the drug stuff, maybe. Just a very strange one that seems like there will really never be any answers to. All right, so that is really it for this episode in this story. I mean, I guess there could be an update if he confesses from...
Will they find remains?
...prison, but... Or they find the remains. I doubt it. Would be amazing to get some closure in this case, but it just seems unlikely. But yeah, we'll have a blog on this case like we always do at truecrimesocietyblog.com if you want to read more about it. And there's so many like Reddit threads and different commentary on it. So if you want to read more about all of that, just give it a Google because you'll find tons of things that are pretty interesting. Make sure you're following us on Instagram at True Crime Society. We always post updates and everything there. And if you want to follow our personal accounts, mine is StephSum_ and Olivia's TCS Olivia, if you want to see what we're up to. And check us out on Patreon if you want more content from us. We do weekly bonus episodes and we do all the episodes ad-free. And then we do earlier release on these episodes as well. And that's really it. Just if you could share to your Instagram stories, that's always a great help too, because it helps us get the word out about the podcast more. So thank you guys for listening. Stay safe out there. Peace out.
See ya.